Welcome to a new episode of Whiplash Agile, where we focus on the failures that are necessary to be successful on an agile journey, because there are always valuable lessons to be learned from someone else's struggles and stumbles. I'm Jeff Anderson, your host and CEO of Agile by Design. All right. Welcome, everyone, to our next episode of Whiplash Agile, where the pain and the progress of Agile is real. I'm pretty excited today to have Ashley Beattie on the podcast. Ashley's actually been working as part of Agile by Design for a good number of years now. But Ashley's got a really interesting story and a unique, I think, blend of experience that I think is doing quite compelling to a lot of people listening. Ashley has been deep in the throes of all things Agile, DevOps and software, SRE kind of type stuff for the last several years. He came to us out of the AI startup world and was talking and singing the song of AI, as well as some of the, you know, potential risks, well before ChatGPT entered the common vocabulary. And Ashley gave a really good presentation in one of Agile by Design's internal kind of workshops. And Ashley painted some really compelling pictures around the intersection of Agile and AI. So we are pretty excited to be talking to you, Ashley. Welcome aboard.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me, Jeff. Looking forward to it.
So let's start with, you know, give people a bit of a general background. Like, what were you doing, you know, before you started working in Agile by Design, specifically in the world of AI and startup land, and some of the things you were learning?
Sure.
And then we'll get into the, you know, what happened next.
I had been doing quite a bit of entrepreneurial stuff in the technology space, software, for a while before joining Agile by Design. And immediately before, I was working on a startup called AdVault. And the real value prop of AdVault was like set and forget ad campaigns, where somebody could just type in who they wanted to target, and then it figured it out and it automatically generated like ad campaigns. So in the back end was a lot of analytics, let's call it. Some of it was AI-ish, but I wouldn't call it what we would call AI today. It was pretty advanced, but that really was also an entry point into what we think of AI today as well, because part of the Toronto tech community was a pretty burgeoning AI scene back in like 2014, when I was, you know, hands and legs and whatever else into startup land. So we started working with the tools at the time that were available to us. And, you know, it was more of a community thing where we were kind of experimenting a lot and got pretty familiar with what it was at that time. This is, you know, almost 10 years ago. And it was pretty impressive. So I knew that it wasn't going to directly apply like the early libraries like Theano and early TensorFlow. Those weren't necessarily something that I was going to bake into my product at the time, but they were really, really interesting. Like, you could generate some really cool music back then and generate some really cool artwork with it. So it was very much a hobbyist kind of approach, but it told the future, you know, in a lot of ways. You could see that there was something here that maybe had been done before, but not this easily. And early natural language processing, called the forebears of modern ChatGPT, were in place. I was using them, nothing like there is today, but they were really powerful. It was very clear to me, and also a lot of members of the Toronto AI scene, this was here to stay. It was going to be a very big thing. And it was just a matter of time before someone had an insane breakthrough, similar to what I think we're seeing now with ChatGPT.
Talk about some of the early work you were doing to help knowledge workers. I think that's pretty appropriate to what Agile practitioners and Agile coaches try to do, which is make the lives of knowledge workers easier. I know this is very much before you had a lot of experience in all things Agile, but you were doing some fairly interesting stuff. So I was wondering if there's some of that.
Not too long before that, actually, before I became like a software developer, entrepreneur kind of person, I was working with the Navy. And one thing that we were doing was we were analyzing the communication paths and the information flow paths between the members of the organization, and just seeing who talked to who and who could transact with who to get a job done. And we would like map the flow of information across the organization. And that generated a lot of really cool insights. Because once you knew who collaborated with who, you started to see these like clusters of work happening throughout the organization. And you got to see what kinds of work people were doing. So in some cases, these were solo jobs that people were doing to essentially move information around, make sure that the form is filled out right. And then there were people that were applying like expert judgment, but they were working as like individuals. So think of this person as like somebody who's doing like legal review or something like that. Like, they were just largely bringing in information and then applying a judgment of some kind. And then there were other groups of people that were working in teams that were making decisions. And these would be like collaborative decision makers. And you had like this really, it was called organizational network analysis. And you could really see how knowledge work got executed in an organization by looking at it almost as if you almost look like a social network. Who knows who interacts with who, and to what intensity do people's interactions happen? And you can do amazing things with that information. Like what I was doing was primarily making recommendations and like optimizations on the organizational model, see whether we could increase the rate at which work could get done. So if I co-located, that's actually something we did. We actually co-located people that had a lot of interconnections, but weren't necessarily working next to each other because we knew that the information was going between these people. They just were sitting really, really far apart. So we co-located people. We also identified where we could create like little communities so that we could shorten the paths of information through the organization and really like accelerate how value got delivered. It was a fascinating exercise. And that was not too much before I joined Agile by Design in my startup stuff.
A lot of people use the MailChimp and command and control as the opposite of Agile, but what you're showing is it's quite the opposite, that co-location, getting people together, increasing the rate of frequency engagement, and the sum matters more than the parts. So the interactions matter more than the individuals.
Yeah, and I think that this is a case at all organizations, that there is a formal organization, which is, you know, the pyramid-looking thing with, you know, who reports to who, and then there's the informal organization, which is who actually interacts with who to get the job done. And that was what we were actually able to tease out of it. So even though you're right, it is a command and control slash hierarchical organization, there definitely is a very vibrant informal organization to getting the work done that we were able to kind of tease out of the information we were able to gather. Fascinating stuff. Very, very fascinating stuff.
So talk about some of your early forays. I remember I'd been introduced to you. You had a good, what I'll call like agile adjacent background. And then we got you into becoming a practitioner, then a coach. You very quickly gravitated to some of the work type pieces. What, I'm not doing it justice. Why don't you describe some of the things you're doing, some of the challenges, anything you can share with others?
When you're in startup land, it's like go MVP or die, when it really comes down to it. I'd been doing startups for a number of years. My first startup was a wearable startup. So we were doing like wearable motion detection, and like it was thinking about an open source wearable. And one of the things we did right away was we made a little tiny prototype and showed it to people on the street. So we were on King Street downtown Toronto, and just anybody who walked by, hey, what do you think about this thing? What would you do with it? And that really framed how we thought about value delivery. We just thought that, hey, we talked to a lot of people. We're talking hundreds of people by this point. This is what they would actually want. And that became a driver of our backlog. So think of that as what you would do as a product team today, is talk to your customer or talk to a potential customer, figure out what they want, and then make it possible, really. Because at the end of the day, startups are really, really, really hard. You had to make some decisions that didn't necessarily give them everything they wanted, but you had to do what you could to address that need. So that was by necessity. And then as I got more into my own software companies, my own software development, I was building like what we might call like an early version of a story map. And I actually was looking through some of my pictures not too long ago, and I had a big wall in my room, and I had written down all the stickies. I actually had stickies on my wall. And this is long before I'd
been
really
indoctrinated by Agile by Design.
If we're going to call it that, yeah.
Educated, yes. Yeah.
But part of it was that was just a good way of thinking about problem solving.
Right.
That don't try and tackle all the problem at once. Tackle what you need to tackle. And I even could see that I had been prioritizing in some ways. You know, it's like that was going to happen before this one. And while everybody, you know, who's probably listening to this, and a lot of the Agile coaches that we'd interact with have probably been like, Ashley, that's a really good start. There's a lot for you to learn here. It was definitely a very useful tool for me, because not only do we know now the benefits of visualizing our work, but also just to kind of keep sight on the goal was really helpful.
Contrast, you've been in startup land for the last, you know, how many years, and now you're coaching a big enterprise, big Canadian bank. We could say it's Scotia because, you know, we publicly talked about our work with them. So it was Scotiabank. Talk about, A, how did you bring in some of the startup concepts, and where did it apply? And where was it like a bit of a culture shock when you had to do things?
I brought a lot of agency and urgency to situations. That was really baked into me through startup land. And by bringing that kind of an energy to the situation, I was able to energize people to get moving, right? And like, let's do stuff. Let's actually move this needle and let's do what we can today. Because that's what it's like in a startup. Let's do what we can today. So that energy was definitely a big part of my early coaching experiences. And I think it's still applies heavily today. I think that's still just kind of like who I am and part of my DNA. I also brought a lot of my called like MVP's thinking kind of thing, which was like, hey, like we don't have long, we've got to get something, let's do that. And let's just do that in bare minimum kind of thing. Before we would have said, you know, let's slice the story map and let's identify the MVP. It was much about like, what are we going to do in terms of a little bit of scope? Like soon, let's get it moving. So it kind of brought both of those things. I keep doing that. I think that that's also part of my identity and who I am. But where that runs into friction is that there is friction in organizations with permission, and there's friction in organizations with the ability to actually take that agency and do something with it. And I think that as a coach, we try to do that. We try to provoke. We try to be catalysts at times, but that's still sometimes meets the reality of organizations.
You brought an example? Like give me a real tangible, nasty, limit to permission was getting in the way of providing agency to one of the teams you're working with.
I'm going to try and keep people's names out of it, but like what ends up happening in a lot of cases, we want to do this. It doesn't necessarily align with the roadmap, doesn't exactly align with all of the plans that have already been made. But we think it's the right thing to do and we want to get moving on it like now. It's to address an opportunity, an emerging opportunity. Or we see this risk, we want to de-risk it now. And I get it. There's organizational machinations that may delay that from happening because a lot, and like I have a lot of empathy and a lot of understanding of what it's like to work at a large organization. And I understand that there are things that are outside of almost your view when you're at the team level that bring this delay to bear for a reason. But that's definitely something that happens. And it's definitely something that sometimes we want to reorient the person we're working with to think that it's not necessarily like the enemy is the delay. I like saying that from time to time, but like the more that you can do to address delay in your system, the more agile your system, the more effective your system, the more like you get so many benefits out of that. So I definitely didn't answer your question by using a real example, but I think that what I did say is something that resonates with a lot of people that are listening to this is that sometimes you may not know about the reason why things aren't happening or the things that you can't do, even if you wouldn't necessarily like what they're saying,
right?
It definitely happens.
Okay. So if I take away something out of that, it's definitely understand the system before you start provoking acceleration and then try to work in that system to remove very known kind of problems. But I think what you really said is try to understand the system first would be, you know, before acting. Is that what you're saying?
I think you paraphrase it well.
Okay. So let's go. You've done a whole bunch of stuff on, you know, you started, like, I remember the first few kind of teams you were working with, I would call it sort of like foundational kind of agile flow stories, all that kind of stuff. You then quickly got into sort of helping, I'll call it DevOps at scale. And if you were to kind of list some of the top or like one of the top two or three things that most organizations do wrong when they're trying to introduce DevOps, so what did you guys do a little bit different?
No, I think that would be a great question. Great question. So I think everybody has to except that everybody's DevOps journey is a little bit different, similar to everybody's Agile's journey a little bit different. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of anti-patterns come from wanting to apply a DevOps playbook or sorts. And like, here's the template, go forward. Sometimes that'll work.
What do you mean by the template? Do you mean like the standard tools and one process to fit them all? Everyone goes on the same
exactly,
pipeline.
Exactly that. Like standard tools, standard processes, because sometimes that's actually helpful.
What?
I'm not saying that's not the right thing to do.
Like you're being
sometimes,
generous. What?
But when it comes down to it, it's also important to realize why you're doing it. You're really doing it to unlock the velocity and the throughput and reduce the lead time of the team. And their context really matters when you're trying to do that. And we took a very different approach when we were doing it.
So if you remember the context is there was a centralized DevOps team, one pipeline that everyone had to get onto, a common set of tools that everybody had to use. And then your group, which was more localized, but still big, handed 12 teams, you decided that's when they created a localized team to help out, right? So maybe that's the good context to start going into what you guys did.
Yeah, so about 160 people or so. And we were there to help them deliver with less toil. When it comes down to it, the more the SRE side of things of like reducing the friction in their delivery was really what we were going for. And the thing that we did that actually I can't say that I invented, but it was something that I read about from Twitter's engineering effectiveness group, was that we found a way to assess the toil. And by assessing the size of the toil and the size of the delay, we knew where to invest to get the maximum return. because maybe there's 20 different opportunities you can address to optimize that or automate that or, you know, build a better process around this. But if you knew what the size of the toil was and you knew how much investment it's going to take for you to actually get rid of it, you could prioritize your backlog. So that's what we did. And it ended up being that we worked with our sponsor and told them that, look, if we save anybody or everybody in the portfolio 12 minutes a day.
The whole team now, on average, should save them 12 minutes a day.
On average, yeah. It was 12 minutes a day. Everybody, we pay off the team.
The DevOps team, you mean? You pay off the DevOps team, yeah.
Yeah, so we could say that, well, think about it this way, right? Like if I'm working full-time, I'm not writing code. I have to pay for myself. I've got to find a way to unlock one unit of me worth of capability on the team. So what we did is we sized up where we broke even because we aren't writing code. We're increasing the effectiveness of the group. So we have to like make them, you know, let's say there's 100 of them. We've got to make them to 108 because there's 8 of us, right?
That's right.
Just to cancel out and just to
cancel
even.
It out.
Therefore, like that was how we prioritized.
So instead of starting with tools and like a lot of DevOps transformations start with what tool are we going to use? What platform are we going to do? What goes from internal to cloud? It sounds like you took a very different approach, which was how are we going to make the build, deploy, provision, support kind of function easier on the teams? And just reduce it. And we're just due to some of the same things, but in a much more micro way.
Yeah. And by the end of it, like, and I ended up leaving the team before it like reached its, you know, final state kind of thing. And it still goes on today. But what, by the end of it, we were unlocking like many multiples of our own team. Okay. So like, it was meaning that like there were 10 of us, but we were unlocking like 40 or 50 people because we would find that much toil and that much friction in the process to automate away. And sometimes this also meant accelerating how long it takes to do a build or accelerating automated testing suite running or reducing the number of errors. Like there were so many different places where we could tackle. The benefit of doing it this way, I think, is that you really solve problems for people and therefore they're really, really invested in pairing with you to do it. That's another thing that I think doesn't necessarily get talked about a lot is that you're doing this for humans and you also want to kind of automate yourself out of it. If you're doing a really good job, like you shouldn't be around. Like you should have gotten rid of all this oil because now you don't need me. And therefore you need them to develop their own capability to actually do this on their own. Otherwise you're just another tax on the, you know, on the throughput of the team. So how do we do that? We have to have them pair with us to build it and co-create it. And by doing it that way, you get little champions.
Well, I remember you guys had a Kanban set up, which had the, here's how we figure out what the solution is going to be. Here's how we roll it out. But I remember you having specific states that said, and here's where we count. And the job wasn't done when the thing was built. The job was done when the thing was adopted. So it's very much a different mindset than what I've seen in some other
places.
That
was actually a really powerful policy is that, well, let's not start stuff unless we have a realistic pair to work with on it. Because what we'd end up doing is we just create another dependency on us that isn't really a good long-term strategy. Your DevOps team just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. And eventually somebody goes like, aren't these people writing code, right? Like they should just write code. And sometimes that's the problem is that they're actually spending all their time operating the tools that they put up versus unlocking capability of the team. So I think that was a good direction. It was almost a good starting point for what we were looking to do. And I even looked at this story a little bit recently and I was like, I can't believe it. You know, like just looking at the graphs we had put together of like, look at how much time we cut off. Like it was like a month or two of the overall project shortening. And if you think about like a massive project like that spans multiple years.
That's got 120 folks on it.
It's an absurd number when you actually look at just the cost of running it. So if you cut a month or two of delay off the project, we're talking a really good ROI, an amazing ROI, while not only doing that, but also making developers a little bit happier because they are just like grinding on things that are kind of annoying all the time.
I've always thought if you could create a public investment fund that was based on the return of well done investment opportunities, like technical refactoring, well done DevOps, like not the crazy out of control stuff, but the other one, you probably get like this better ROI than the actual business return itself. You know, it's just, the returns are just insane. I don't know how you'd monetize it or actually track it.
That's what I was just wondering. I'm like, how would you monetize this? But like, there definitely are really awesome opportunities because some of it comes down to specialty. don't know how to do this. Sometimes it comes out to time, which is I just don't have the time to invest in this enabler. And if all of a sudden someone comes around and they go, hey, I have the specialty and I have the ability to do this for you, we're going to make it better for you. And it doesn't cost you some money right away.
Somehow you got to make it cost money. And you're going to teach them how to do it. So
yeah. Wow. Like I think that there's quite a business there. I think you would get a lot of takers on really big projects where like even 1% better is absurd amounts of money.
So let's talk a bit about, you know, I think you framed up the, what I'll call the enabler. Like I like to call them enablers in you know, like your knowledge worker ecosystem as the people in the teams, you know, and as the people that the teams sometimes go to just to get stuff done, kind of firing through that. The stuff that we actually, we don't like that pattern as much, but it's there. You have people that travel in. And then finally, you have these enablers who are high amounts of capability in a specific way. Your architects, your DevOps people, your agile coaches. They're the people whose like knowledge is either highly specialized or there's a high shortage of it. And we need to get it onto a lot of the teams. And you just described one pattern, you know, to kind of like, you know, enable effectively. I want to kind of move into AI a little bit. Because we've been talking about, you talked a little about using AI to support knowledge workers. Talk a little bit about, you know, how do you see AI changing the game for people in the enablement business and knowledge workers in general?
I'll do the knowledge worker in general question before I do the enabler business. Okay. Because I think that what we're seeing is like a profound shift in access to knowledge through AI. And I'll describe what I mean by that. Like back in the early 2000s, late 90s, when search engines came online, it was about access to information that unlocked capability for knowledge work. Because now I could just type it into Google and I could know pretty much anything. And that was their mission, right? Organizing the world's information. But what we're realizing as we interact with these intelligent systems is that they're actually sources of knowledge and a bit more of a how-to and a helper. So what does that do to a knowledge worker? Well, now I have way more power, I have way more capability. I can do way more. I might be able to accelerate a whole bunch of things. I might be able to be like three knowledge workers in one, maybe even more, depending on how good I am with these tools. So if what I've done is I've essentially 3x'd the effectiveness of every knowledge worker out there.
Is that what you think the increase is going to happen to your knowledge workers? Thanks, AR.
I think it depends on the type of knowledge worker. So like you're a lot about developers that are like way back, miles and miles and miles. And I think it's just because of the nature of their work. It's very, very structured. There's a really rich legacy of training data to actually build a good pair. So I think that there's certain types of knowledge work that will really, really, really benefit. And then there are other types of knowledge work that may not be such a huge level up, but still will be in the, you know, multiple X's of effectiveness. And I think that that acceleration and that capability is going to do a whole bunch of things.
What about even like base capability? Like we in the agile world, we love to talk about T-shaped people. And the T-shaped person is deep in one thing, but kind of like can get away with a few other things. So that's why I guess what I'm saying. There's this big intersection between AI and the kind of organizational models that we espouse, because you're never going to get to become an expert on something. Maybe not never, but now for sure, you're not an instant expert in a new domain just because, you know, you've got an AI chatbot, but you can certainly get, you know, enough intelligence to engage us a lot faster.
Oh, yeah. Well, that actually is a really good point you're making, which is that there are types of skills that you want to be really, really, really good at to leverage this AI power up. And that's things like sense making. So to what extent can you critically evaluate what the AI has put in front of you? Because when it comes down to it, it's just going to say something. It might hallucinate. And by hallucinate, what I mean is it might confidently assert a fact that is actually false. And without the ability to critically evaluate that information and whatever advice it's just given you or help it's just given you, you might become like a weapon of mass destruction at your organization.
It's kind of like when you hire a big consulting firm and you don't necessarily know the domain, you might get something really, really good. Or I guess it could happen with a small consulting firm too, but you know, that's like the danger of using any external advice is it's like a bazooka, right? It doesn't necessarily help you fire it in the right direction.
So yeah, that is the exact same skill, critical evaluation. But now it's not just the execs that are going to use that. It's everybody. It needs to be able to critically evaluate what it did. Like think about like how it writes emails for people. So you can just click the little button and now it writes you an email. Well, if you don't really evaluate what it did and assess whether that is a good line to write in this email to this person, given their context and given that you might do something very, very bad. And that's what I'm talking about, is this ability to critically evaluate will be a very, 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 very important skill. It'll just become like one of those foundational necessity skills that everybody tests for before they put you in a seat that is going to be supercharged by AI.
Well, AI kind of right now is kind of like a co-op student that's extremely, extremely fast and has like structural kind of hygiene, but it could just do like the most immature stuff that you're like, it's like your best kind of like person on your team that just started out. You're like, whoa, okay, I got to slow you down a little bit. So yeah, that definitely does not go away. Where's some other skills? So you mentioned sort of sense making, critical evaluation.
You're going to need, given that like now every knowledge worker is like three knowledge workers, you're going to need as a knowledge worker to bridge between different groups. Because now it's like if two of us are coming together, it's actually like eight of us. And therefore, think of what that means for us, our ability to collaborate. And it means that I'm going to have to be a better facilitator. I'm going to have to be able to kind of keep more things organized between the two groups. And this grows. Like you think about your normal scrum team, what, 7 to 11 people? Like all of a sudden, that's a massive amount of capability to bring to bear. So how do you facilitate? How do you create shared awareness? How do you create like a frame for thinking among, you know, four or five people that are going to now operate independently with their little AI is going to be very, very, very.
The number of functions is applied to a small, because there's two ways of descaling. One is you descale the amount of functional complexity in your thing. And the other is you just descale the scope. So Agile works well when you really descale the scope and you bring in everything for operations and development and architecture, and you don't descale the functions, you descale the scope so that you bring all the functions together. Sounds like this is going to both require and enable that kind of thinking,
yeah,
but to
exactly,
accelerate.
Exactly. And like without belaboring what this is, like there's like an entire category of skills called meta skills that are, I think, the real ones,
yeah,
which are like communication skills, facilitation skills, sense making. Like you can just Google what meta skills are, but they're essentially skills that help you develop other skills.
But these are really the knowledge worker skills that I was alluding to before, right? If you want to be a good knowledge worker, you have
exactly,
to continue
exactly.
to refine these pieces. Let's flip over to enablers then. Okay. So that's you got this knowledge workers, AI in general, it's going to help them increase their knowledge. It's going to help them take on new domains faster. It's going to help them collaborate better. There's still going to be some domains that require an incredible amount of depth. As an example, I've been asked to help my friends over at Paradise Mobile on their roaming opportunities, and I don't know anything about roaming. And I'm just like using, bots to help me learn more about it and everything. But it's like, it's not going to be tomorrow that I learn anything about this stuff. I still need the roaming expertise in a person. So that doesn't go away necessarily, right? So there's a lot of people worried that AI is going to go and replace the expert, what I'm calling the enablers of the organization.
Okay.
So let's talk about the enablement.
I think the enablement job gets harder. I think it definitely gets harder because now you're competing with another enabler, right? Like think that now, let's just say your business is advice. Well, now you're competing with a robot advisor that's available on demand when anybody wants at all hours of the night that is getting better, that is learning, as a pretty powerful advisor, right? So you're definitely competing with some. Yes, I think it is.
Is it
because
competition?
At the end of the day, like this is, it may not compete on quality, it may compete on cost. So therefore, if they can see that this robo-advisor costs way less for something that is equivalent or even close, you're definitely in competition. You're in the consideration set.
I guess I always looked at it as you'd be building the advisor. Someone has to feed that advisor, right?
Totally.
Someone has to correct
it when
it's
wrong. And this
will
work with all types of advice right away. But I don't think it's long before it does. And what I mean by that is that it's not long before it becomes an amazing lawyer. Amazing. It's not long before it becomes, for certain types of advice, amazing at it. We're seeing with coding already, right? Like a lot of the recommendations it's making, it can explain. That would have been done by somebody who was, a clean code expert or something.
Well, even imagine, let's take most enterprises have very, I'll call them, if not proprietary, very distinct architectural topologies. Their systems are their own, they're a language unto themselves. You're on the relationship between those systems and the behaviors. And usually your average developer has no clue beyond the system they're working on. And to kind of work across all the systems, they'll bring in the full-time sort of systems architect who explains the inner workings where all the bodies are buried and all that kind of good stuff. Wouldn't the architect's job now make it so that he's not so scarce? He's got to program that thing. He's got to make sure that it's right and got to check its results. But he can now use that as almost
a buddy. That's a really, really good use case. And you're seeing this already with custom GPTs, right? Where people can essentially recreate themselves And that's definitely going to happen because that just means that architect is available at 3 a.m. when you need some information right away because you have a P1, right? Like that is a really, really powerful use case for an enabling function.
And maybe you don't need as many architecture dates because the architect could have said, did you ask my GPT yet? What did it say? Give me the questions and give me the answers and then I'll tell you.
It'll escalate to me if it doesn't know. Like there'll be interesting things like that. But let's come back to like the whole like professional enabler. I think that what the job is going to become a lot about is like managing the human relationship, because at the end of the day, these are human to human interactions. I think that that's going to become even more important, like helping person. It's going to be a long time before that bot knows whether I'm stressed out or it's going to be a long time whether they know whether I'm bringing, you know, another bag, a bit more baggage to work than I normally would. And therefore, I'm a little bit less capable of managing the advice. Like the human is going to become so much more important. And then I think there's another part of this, which is the anti-pattern and knowing how to shape advice in such a way that the person that's receiving it is aware that either they're going down a path that they may not want to go down, or this is the implication of the decision you're making. Because I have experience.
No decisions are clean, right? There's always an implication.
None. Yeah. And that definitely means that more practitioners and deeply knowledgeable people who have examined the patterns and the structure of systems will become very useful because they'll have gotten a good understanding of how this situation is going to evolve and therefore will be very, very, very capable as advisors. But like, who knows? At the end of the day, like you may end up, like this space is evolving so quickly.
The way you're describing it right now, though, AI sounds like a friend to the agilist in terms of helping with cross-functionality, helping with bringing in more domains, helping spread out the enablers. What's the dangers? What are some of the risks? I mean, we know some of the common doom and gloom ones, but like specifically to this use case, where does this start to fall apart?
I think it comes back to the beginning or the earlier part of that I was talking about, was the failure of sense making to use the advice well. And I see this already where there's like an illusion of competence from people that are using AI a lot. But just because the AI said what to do, it doesn't mean you can actually do it. And it doesn't mean that the advice was actually good advice. So you may end up with situations where people blindly accepted the advice of the AI. And because they're so powerful now, like think about like the tool that this is. There's like a, you know, now I have a marketer at my disposal, a legal person at my disposal, a coder at my disposal, you know, like all of these things. It means that we could go in the wrong direction very, 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 very fast. All right. So like this is where I think
feedback becomes even more
hugely important. And like, how do you train somebody to look for that versus like this confirmation bias that the AI told me to do it and I'm just going to keep going? Because I've been there. I actually have been there where I had too big of an ego, call it, to absorb the feedback and was willing to keep going because I had conviction, even though it wasn't probably the right way to go. And if I look back on it now, I'm like, I would probably have shaken myself and I would have said, hey, like zoom out just a little bit and see what the feedback's actually saying versus just continuing blindly. And I think that that's also going to be a hard thing to teach people how to do, which is, you know, the market is real. It plays.
So it sounds like we need agile. Despite all the talk, we need agile coaches more than ever.
You might. And that's maybe that.
Maybe we'll call it agile. We'll call it something.
Maybe that's anti-pattern coach kind of person, which is to kind of be the angel on the shoulder in a way. Maybe the devil from time to time, but you get the idea, which is here's where you're going or here's the piece of information you're missing. And I also think that, and I use ChatGPT quite a lot. I'm definitely a way better, you know, knowledge worker myself with its use. So I think that enablers also become better. So maybe this doesn't go away. It's all we just get replaced. We also have to develop ourselves and evolve a little bit. And also, this is, I think, a meta skill too, which is learning how to learn. We're going to have to be better at learning and we're going to have to use AI to help us learn more quickly so as to become even more valuable in the domains and in the workplaces that we're helping. Because otherwise, we're going to get outcompeted. It's just going to happen.
Words of wisdom. We're out of time. Is there anything else you want to leave with us before you go? Either showing of your work or just anything
else
you want to
leave with anybody who's listening? Agile with AI in the picture is becoming a competitive necessity for organizations. And what I mean by that is that everybody is going to go faster. Everybody is going to go faster, a lot faster. And there are going to be so many new products on the market all the time. And there's going to be so much change that agile is now the only way to survive. the only way to stay on the innovative edge or get disrupted. So I think that there's a competitive imperative that's happening with AI and the increased use of AI in organizations that mean that, yeah, well, I'll say it from, you know, a person, you know, at least we have jobs, but I also mean that like it's going to become the operating system of organizations going forward. And I don't think we've thought very much about what the agile AI organization looks like from a more philosophical or even just like a functional perspective. Like what is that? And what is it like to be a leader in those organizations? I don't know yet. And I think that that's something that like is kind of sitting here at the back of my mind, just kind of sitting in the subconscious and turning. But it's something that I'm kind of looking forward to. I think it'll be interesting at least.
Well, I definitely think team orientation is going to become more important. Feedback and market orientation is going to become more important. The person at the top making the decisions is going to be even less relevant because everybody's going to be hooked up to these super intelligent devices giving advice. Yeah, so I think it's an acceleration of what's already there. But you do ask some interesting questions around some of the leadership pieces and how far and how fast this will go because of AI.
Going to be very interesting. And I'll just add this. It may, like, if this is happening in every single organization, because this is a general purpose technology, every knowledge worker, it means that organizations that have had difficulty doing agile and being more agile well are now going to have to start opening their, you know, their aperture a little bit to see whether this is something they can do, because it may be that there are competitive pressures that are coming that weren't there before this happened, that now force a reckoning with taking a more agile approach. And we'll see what that's like. At the end of the day, like I could be completely wrong, but I actually look forward to that future where a lot of the friction in organizations is gone. And a lot of, think about how much better all the services that we rely upon from governments, large corporations, small, whatever they are, if they were just way more effectively delivered, how much better life might be. So I think that there's going to, once the path is shown, I think that this is going to be something that people lean into very heavily, becomes a new expectation. And I kind of look forward to that.
Yeah, myself as well. It's nice to hear a positive outlook. Well, Ashley, thanks again.
Cheers, thank you very much.
It was really good talking to you.
Thanks again for joining me on Whiplash Agile. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss a single episode. If you want to connect with me, join me on LinkedIn or Twitter/X. And if you like what you hear, or especially if you don't like what you hear, get in touch with me directly at agilebydesign.com.